Okay. Again, it's a real privilege and honor for me. Oops, wait. Oh. It's a privilege and an honor for me to be here with you. Once again, thank you for the invitation. So tonight is kind of, I think it's going to end up being a two-parter. I promised a topic when I was here last time, letting go of and letting go into. And there are a few things I want to say before that that relate to maybe it would be called the power of this practice or the empowerment of this sort of practice. So we'll see how it goes. I think I'll do both those. I'll be able to. We'll see where it goes. This practice, simple technique, not easy, but simple technique, is so powerful and empowers us so much that I think from time to time it's helpful to remind ourselves of the value of it. Really, any time we spend here in practice is easily worth its weight in gold. And it's particularly wonderful for me to be here with you, this large group of people very dedicated to this practice, to feel actually the goodness of that. In the Theravada teachings, the proximate cause, the proximal cause, I'm not quite sure about those words in English, the cause that gives rise to loving kindness is seeing goodness. And so it becomes a practice technique to take a moment to see and feel the goodness in others, and also, and maybe in here in the West especially, in ourselves, so that we can feel the arising of loving kindness and gentle friendliness toward ourselves. There's also a word in English, wholesomeness. The wholesomeness of this practice, there's another phrase, leading onward. This practice is leading onward. And where is it leading? To more peace, to more happiness, eventually to that place called enlightenment. So it has power, strength, and wholesomeness. And they call that a confirmation from the universe. Guess I'm not wrong, right? For those listening to the tape, that was a choir just gave off a lovely, lovely confirming note. So I want to take a look for the beginning of this evening at the practice technique itself that we're using and how it is cultivating these mental factors of mindfulness and concentration. We learn that in our basic classes on this kind of meditation, that two particularly important mental factors that we are bringing forward with this kind of practice is the mental factor of mindfulness and the mental factor of concentration. And our technique strengthens both of those in different ways, different levels for different people. But a key aspect of why that's important, again, has to do with the deeper aspect of this practice. This kind of practice has some just kind of ordinary world things that are actually also quite wonderful. You know, it results in more relaxation. medical community would say that there are things that happen physically in the body. You know, it can have a positive effect on normalizing blood pressure. Research now indicates there are some really good things that it's doing for the immune system and so forth. So there, and also certainly lots going on in modern psychology demonstrating that this practice also has a very, very positive effect on psychological health and healing. So all of those things are quite wonderful to see and know, and great motivators for our practice. And then in addition, the deeper level is, of course, has to do with this practice as a spiritual path and what its particular flavor and direction is as a spiritual practice and as a spiritual path. And this has to do with, again, in our basic courses, we talk about the Buddha teaching the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And what we might say is the core element of this whole teaching as a path, which is to be able to understand these Four Noble Truths. The word noble is the translation of the word Arya. So they're the four Arya truths. And an Arya is someone who has accomplished at least to the level, the first of four levels of enlightenment. And then they call it stream entry. So then a person becomes an Arya. And so the four Arya truths are things that are obvious, obviously true to Aryas. So they're the things that Aryas see quite clearly right away. Maybe not so obvious to non-Aryas, but on our path we engage in reflection and then practice that will take us into the ability to see these truths. And of course, quick summary, suffering, there is suffering. The situation here, just by virtue of being born, has qualities of suffering, unsatisfactoriness, stress, distress. That's our situation. Second truth is that it is actually possible. The cause of the suffering, which has to do with craving, clinging, and attachment. And then the third is the possibility of lessening and even ending the suffering. And the fourth is the punchline, that the way to do that, the way to alleviate the suffering, is to follow the Eightfold Path. So what the implication in these Four Noble Truths is that our existence as it is, our ordinary way of being, does not allow us to see this at all clearly. And so our ordinary way of being results in behavior that we actually might think is going to give us happiness. And because most of us don't say, here I am on the planet and I'm going out intentionally to suffer. You know, generally speaking, most people want to be happy and are following behaviors and activities that they think might make them happy, and yet it's not working. And it's not just not working now, it never worked. This is why someone like the Buddha went, practiced for many years, and then finally sat down under the Bodhi tree to see the deeper truth of what's going on. So the implication is that ordinary perception won't get us there. We'll just bumble around doing things that we think are going to make us happy, but actually give rise to suffering. So then it's wonderful that that's not the end of the story, but the teachings tell us that there is a possibility to see how it's actually working, what's causing suffering, what would give rise to happiness. But then to do it, we have to have a path that includes practice. Our practice includes the cultivation of these mental factors, wholesome mental factors, and then particularly with our meditation, focusing on the notion of mindfulness and concentration. So the mental factor of mindfulness, we are born with the possibility of cultivating mindfulness, but most people without training don't go around with a lot of mindfulness. Some will go around with more or less concentration, and certainly we have things, disciplines, that will train us in more concentration. You know, there's mathematics, there's sports, there's art and music and so forth. There's a lot of ways that concentration can be trained. Mindfulness, it needs to be almost pointed out to us what it actually is. And then very much a case of practice, continual practice, continual practice. So a demonstration, again, many of you already know, but it's fun to do, to remind us. So all of you have been sitting there looking at me, so seeing has been occurring. But for most, there probably wasn't mindfulness of seeing. But now that I say it, mindfulness of seeing sensation, now you can feel you just added something. Some kind of awareness and knowing just was inserted. Now seeing is occurring, right? Seeing is occurring. There's a knowing that seeing is occurring. That's mindfulness, the mental factor of mindfulness. Now I'm going to say hearing. So again, you were all listening to me, so the hearing sensation was occurring, but was there mindfulness in those previous moments that the hearing sensation was occurring? For many of us, there probably wasn't. So then I mentioned mindfulness of hearing, and now we add something. We add this awareness that the hearing sensation is occurring. Are you still mindful of seeing? Or did that fall away as mindfulness of hearing came up, right? And how about there's pressure sensation, the bottom of our seat, the bottom of our feet. Are we mindful of that? So we can see how we need practice to first understand what mindfulness is, then to cultivate it and to practice so we can keep it available to us. Because so often, without attention, and we might even say without some concentration, the mindfulness will fall away. So all folks are conscious and moving through life, but how many are mindfully aware moment to moment of even just basic seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, and certainly then mindfulness of thinking itself? We all have great expertise with thinking, but our practice technique, that's what's so wonderful about it. It brings up this mental factor of mindfulness. It gives us a way to practice concentration. And then it also gives us this moment when we actually see thinking itself, as opposed to being caught in it, stuck in it. And again, particularly in our meditation session, we distinguish those two. So it's a wonderful thing. Often we think, oh, the mind shouldn't wander, like we're doing something wrong. But actually, if the mind didn't wander, we wouldn't have a chance of seeing thinking. So the mind wandering is great for our technique of practice, because it wanders off, and then at some point we wake up. And we realize, or maybe you hear my voice, or there's another voice, or a wonderful cell phone concert, which I personally enjoyed. I haven't met a ring yet that I don't like, so but there will be one, I suppose. In any case, something like that happens, you know. It's the poor person might feel embarrassed, but she knows me, so she doesn't. She knows I don't mind. But if we drop something, and yet, just think of it. You woke up 12 people, you know. It's really great. So so then that moment comes, and then we notice, whoa, you know, I was just planning next Tuesday's trip to Jiffy Lube, you know? I was just scheduling next week for the oil change. And so then there's a moment there where we're actually seeing thinking. And in that moment of seeing thinking, we are no longer in the thinking. So this, again, this is our training. We are no longer identified with the story, but we're in a position to see the story. We see the thinking. That's mindfulness of thinking. Or maybe there's an emotion present, or maybe we have a reaction, you know. We're enjoying the cell phone, or we're embarrassed, or we're upset, or something like that, something happening. And then we wake up and we have the opportunity for that moment to see and acknowledge. Some people will have the silent mental note, so they'll say, oh, planning. You know, this was planning. Or this is enjoying. Or this is worrying. Or this is embarrassment. Or this is frustration. Or this is judging. So this is a tremendously powerful thing that our practice gives us, because folks in the civilian world don't generally have that opportunity. And there are a few disciplines, and our practice is one of those that allows us to see the thinking mind itself. We bring the mental factor of mindful awareness to thinking itself. And then, the next moment, we practice renunciation. Again, we're not monastics here, and we might think when we hear that word renunciation that it means somehow shaving our head and going off into a monastery or something. But actually, throughout our sitting meditation, our walking meditation practice, each time first we come awake, we bring mindfulness to the distracting element, whatever it is, and then in the next moment we have a choice. And it's a renunciation choice, because very, very often the daydream, the fantasy, the planning of next week's schedule is much more interesting to us than the breath sensations, right? So sometimes it's like you're literally dragging your attention. You know, you grab it with both hands metaphorically and drag it back to the breath. But there's a willingness there, and sometimes there's not. You know, sometimes we say, I don't care. I'm thinking about this for the next 5 minutes. I'm just going, you know, a little mindfulness vacation for a moment. But eventually we do have that moment of renunciation. We let go of the story. And in that moment, again, there's tremendous power and empowerment, because we are now no longer controlled by that story. And that's the piece that's in ordinary civilian life is going on all the time. We're just controlled, sort of jerked around. We're puppets of this ongoing narrative in which we are the star, right? This is who I am. This is what I think. This is what I'm doing tomorrow. This is what I did yesterday. This is how I feel. And this is what I'm going to tell so-and-so about that. There's dialogue just going on constantly. This is who I am. This is what I feel. This is what I think. This is what I'm going to tell so-and-so. This is what I'm going to do tomorrow. This is what I did yesterday. This is what I regret about yesterday. And so on. This keeps going and going and going. But in our practice, we are now connecting with and engaging in this possibility of moving out of the identification with the story with attention and awareness, with mindfulness. A very powerful and empowering moment. And we keep practicing it. And then we need an anchor, you know. Now some of you have maybe put in a decade or two of practice or more. And then at a certain point you don't so much need anchoring sensations. But the first couple of decades or so, it's good to have some anchor, like the breath, or maybe people are doing sweeping technique or something. At some point, we can let go into just pure awareness itself, and that's wonderful. But it's perfectly fine to keep using an anchor. We anchor our attention in the sensations of the breath or something in the body, and then we're very present. In fact, some people, we're finding all kinds of English words that work for this kind of practices. So some people will say we're practicing presence. And I kind of like that too. You know, it means awake, aware, mindful, clear, present, but we're not engaged in thinking. Or if there's thinking going on, we know it. We're not totally identified with it. So, for example, many of us, probably everyone here, uses thinking for work, or daily life, school, and so forth. So it's not that it's a bad thing. It's a tool and has wonderful applications and so forth. But when we're caught in it, and particularly in the unwholesome kinds of thinking, you know, jealousy, worry, judgment, criticism, self-doubt, that list goes on and on. Those kinds of thinking really have no benefit. They cause us harm, they cause others harm, they cloud our minds. They, again, modern medicine, they don't have such a good effect on our bodies either. So that kind of thinking, we're empowering ourselves to disengage from, to not dwell in, and to not identify. The Theravada tradition has wonderful language, the adventitious defilements of mind. Isn't that great? The adventitious defilements of mind, the unwholesome conditioned habit patterns of judgment and worry and envy, jealousy, criticism, anger, those kinds of things, the adventitious defilements of mind. So this simple but not easy practice technique is training us, building a kind of a muscle to allow us to bring forth mindfulness, the mental factor of mindfulness, to strengthen concentration so that for moment after moment we can empower ourselves to be free of that ongoing narrative and our identification with it. And there's just tremendous power in that. And the reason is, again, the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering, it has to do with grasping and clinging, and the possibility of change. What we need to do is to change our way of perceiving what's actually going on here. And we can't do it at normal speeds. So we need to bring forth mindfulness, we need to bring forth concentration, we need to see what thinking is and what it does, and slow this all down so that we can begin to notice that the way we've actually been seeing the world is not the way the world actually is. And the best comparison I know, of course, a lot of people use this, even though now we're in the digital age, but we go back to the movie projector, right? So a movie projector, you've got a film on a screen, and most of the time we just fall into it. I love movies. I just love movies. And so to fall in totally, and we're involved in this whole story, but it is completely unreal, and it's unreal on so many levels. Particularly if it's, you know, maybe if it's a news thing, there's some outer reality. But let's say it's a fiction movie. So none of the characters are real. All of the people are actors. The plot line has been created. The plot isn't real. And then when you think of a you know, projector and film and so forth, what's happening there is not, what's actually happening is there are little bits of some kind of film with a light shining through, moving very quickly, and moving so quickly that these little pictures are perceived as people, movement, and so forth. I love Sidney Poitier talks about when he was a little boy in the islands, and he lived on such a small island, he didn't see movies for years. They had to go to the bigger island. And the first time he was able to do that and saw a movie, after it was done, he went around the back of the building and waited to see, he wanted to see the people that he'd just seen there going out the back. And he was very, very confused because he couldn't find those people anywhere. And then Sidney Poitier walks the path of that particular discipline. He walks it so far that he becomes a great actor then he becomes a director and a writer and so forth. So you could say that he walked the entire path of that practice from someone who had even no idea the experience, no idea what was really going on there, to someone who had completely accomplished all of that path, to be both in the story as an actor, then to write, to direct, to produce, those kinds of things, accomplishing the whole path. And in that, of course, he learned everything about what we might call the alternate reality of movies. He knew everything about it, from remembering, because he can still tell the story, he could still tell the story of that childlike wonder, to actually being an accomplished actor, then a director, then writer, producer, and so forth. Accomplished the entire path. What we're doing is a bit like that. We're at first we start out living in a world that we think is real, and we think that we know how it works. But through our practice, we're actually cultivating some skills and some abilities. And one thing, we want to slow it all down, slow our perception down, so that we can see how it's actually working. And we can, over the weeks, months, years, and decades of practice, begin to see it acted out in front of us, the causes of suffering and the causes of happiness. So that's a big part of what we're training to do and what we're learning. And then we can move along the path of accomplishment and see more and more, understand more and more, but we need to keep practicing. We need to be attentive to this practice because it is giving us the skills to do that. I have an old friend who teaches in film school in Canada, he might be, you know, in this comparison with films and our practice, he might be, what he does might be considered the mindfulness factor, because he has such skills. He could walk into a film and in a half a second he'd know if if it was just slightly off, you know, the focus or something like that. Or he would say things like, you know, this projector needs a new bulb, you know, or there's fuzziness there immediately. And what was strange is he has very thick glasses, astigmatism and so forth, but became a master of seeing anyway. So in that discipline, he just can see everything. So it's very interesting because you could be in a room, you know, maybe at home watching a film and be just completely plunged in. And then he could walk in and say, man, don't you want to straighten out the focus of that? You know, that's off focus. Or, there's a scratch there. And suddenly you're no longer lost in the story. You realize, oh, this is a film. There's a film projector. It's out of focus, that sort of thing. The story just dissolves like that. In a way, our mindfulness practice and our mindfulness training over time does a similar thing. We begin to see what's actually going on in our chains of experience. We see that sensations arise, and we'll just take the five basic sense doors now: hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling. Won't talk about this yet. A sensation arises, seeing sensation, hearing sensation, and it arises as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then immediately, desire for the pleasant might arise, aversion to the unpleasant, completely zoning out about the neutral, just not even noticing the neutral. And this kind of thing happens as chains of experience, constantly, 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 and that results in behavior. It results in our behavior of others. This is the sort of thing that we're training ourselves to see with our practice, is actually to see the structure of how things are working, the cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. And what we begin to understand is that a tremendous amount of behavior actually is conditioned habit patterns. reactivity, liking the pleasant, disliking the unpleasant. Wouldn't be a problem if liking and wanting what's pleasant and disliking what's unpleasant led to a path of freedom from suffering. But in ordinary civilian life, without any spiritual practice, without any mindfulness practice, it doesn't. Liking the pleasant leads to wanting more pleasantness. Disliking the unpleasant leads to wanting to get rid of everything and everyone that we don't like. This doesn't lead to happiness. If it did, that's what the Buddha would have taught. But it doesn't. It just leads to tremendous suffering and confusion. So, at the heart of our practice technique is this empowerment to see what's actually going on, and then this invitation to continue to proceed, to train, to strengthen these mental factors. It is a discipline. Sometimes we don't want to say the D word. It's a practice, it's a discipline. But it offers us this invitation to become empowered to see very clearly what's going on so that we can cultivate wisdom. And so our mindfulness practice, our insight practice, a lot about wisdom. Because if we begin to understand what's actually causing suffering, then we at least have a chance. We're much more likely, less likely, to make choices that would lead to suffering. You know, if I'm standing here holding somebody, the classic hot potato, somebody throws me a hot potato, you know, and I stand here and I'm holding it and I'm saying, ouch, ouch, my hand hurts. And someone would say, well, Jude, you know, the potato is hot, it's burning your hand, let go of it. You know, we have to teach small people these basic things. So the causes that, and so once I know, oh, that's what's causing the suffering, of course I let it go. Very simplistic example, but so often we don't understand, and we look at the world and we see the world doesn't understand. Generation after generation, people keep trying to get as much pleasantness as they can. Apparently trying to get rid of as much unpleasantness and all the people that they consider unpleasant in any one, you know, subgroup. Obviously that's not working either. Generation after generation, it just doesn't work. So obviously ordinary state of mind, ordinary life isn't teaching that. But our practice is strengthening and training aspects of the mind-body process, these mental factors, that indeed will help us see clearly. Much like with the movie, you know, when you finally slow it down and then you get that frame by frame and then you realize, oh, the people aren't real, the story isn't real. What's really going on here is this kind of way of creating illusion. And then we can even engage in that if there are things that we want to do once we understand the causes. So two for our practice, it is helping us cultivate wisdom to see the causes and conditions that give rise to happiness, to see the causes and conditions that give rise to our suffering, and then we have a chance. We can insert wisdom. Then also we have the other wing. They talk often the Dharma is like a bird with two wings. Wisdom and compassion. You've never seen a bird fly with one wing. So of course we then understand, oh, we must cultivate compassion as well. And then we have our beautiful techniques given to us of the loving kindness practice and training, which again are set up very, very carefully by people with generations of meticulous experience on seeing what actually causes loving kindness to arise? What are the enemies of loving kindness arising? What causes compassion to arise? And so on. And you can study and read about these practices. Very, very meticulous, very reasoned. The causes and conditions that will give rise to happiness, give rise to compassion. And then, as you've heard me say before, we begin also to realize that the path of compassion is a path, it really doesn't have any dropouts. You know, there are other paths people drop out of, but I've yet to run into someone who said, I sincerely tried compassion for 5 years, but I didn't like it. I'm going back to just being cranky and mean. You know, you don't get that. From people who sincerely engage and cultivate it, that's it. There are no dropouts. You know? So we want to do that. We have our techniques. We've been offered them. And then, of course, we have to practice them. That's the key. But very, very good techniques for training for that. So then the result is that we are developing this bird, this bird-like beingness in ourself with the wing of wisdom and the wing of compassion. And we keep training and we keep developing that to see suffering and what causes suffering and to make choices to move in directions that let release suffering, give rise to happiness. So then that brings me around now to another element that I had promised to speak about just a little bit more, the aspect of our practice that has to do with letting go, and particularly that there's two kind of flavors of letting go. There's letting go of, and there's letting go into. And so, again, I want to give you a taste of that and know, again, the first 45 minutes where we were sitting here and practicing, we also, in our very simple but not easy technique, have the opportunity to train in this very deep practice of letting go. So I'd like to read the words of Ajahn Chah, the great 20th century Thai forest master. Do everything with a mind that lets go. Do not expect any praise or reward. If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will know complete peace and freedom. Your struggles with the world will have come to an end. Wow, huh? Ajahn Smith says that's the core of his teaching. Let go, let go, let go. Do everything with a mind that lets go. So, what is this mind that lets go, and how is our practice training us for it? So, a couple of things letting go of and letting go into. So when we're doing our practice and we wake up, we have that moment of waking up. Well, let's start with, okay, before that. We walk in and just by coming here is a process of letting go. We all, as a group, we let go of individual kind of behavioral things. We all agree we'll sit quietly. We won't be popping up to do this and that. We've decided silence. I just taught a weekend at Cloud Mountain. It was a weekend for real beginners. So my job is to really try to impress the value of silence. And there's actually only one silent day. They come Friday, then we have Saturday, and then Sunday afternoon is going, so that by Sunday morning we're beginning to break silence and so forth. So it's just one silent day, and I'm practically begging, you know, to try to transmit. Not only are you going to like this, it's going to be okay, you're going to like it, you're going to want more, right? As so many of you know from having done retreats. But the first one is kind of scary. You know, people don't know, can I spend a whole day in silence? So there is this agreement to let go of a lot of ordinary stuff right away. And here in the evening here, we come in, and some people will spend evenings at evening workshops, but they don't expect that they're going to be completely silent the entire time. But we do expect that. We let go of that. We may have the urge to talk, but we let go of it, and we come here So there's a lot we let go of. We also let go of our shoes, for example. So little things, big things, profound things, there is this willingness, this choice that's made to come here that involves already some letting go. And then as we engage in our practice again and again, these thoughts arise. You know, thinking, planning, worrying, judging, the endless judging. I mean, don't you want to sometimes just take off your head, leave it there with your shoes? You know? It's like, I mean, everyone here, the goodness of the people here just, you know, sometimes brings me to tears. I feel so fortunate that I hang out with very excellent people. Kenneth Roshi, this phrase, excellent people. Anybody who's going to come here and do this kind of practice, you just know right away they're people you want to know. At IMS, it was, in the early days, it was very funny because people would make jokes about there was a library, but you couldn't read, and there was this, but you couldn't do this, there was that, there's that, and there were all these wonderful people, but you couldn't talk to any of them. You know? So this is the situation. There are all these marvelous people, but we actually can't talk to each other. So excellent people. We come, and then we sit down and we engage in this practice of training the mind and the heart, which is very difficult, to become present. And then this judging mind comes up all the time. And it's, as I said, group of excellent people. Nobody here has, you know, kind of, I've come to judge. But yet you sit down quietly and the judging mind just runs itself, runs till you think you're going to be exhausted from it. So this is something that we're all dealing with, the habits, the judging mind, self, other, whatever. It'll judge anything, you know? Comparing, and then the difficult emotions and so forth. So it's not an easy practice at all. And yet we volunteer. You know, we come here, we sit down. So in our practice, when the mind wakes up and we're lost in thinking, judging, comparing, and so forth, then we look at it, we see it, and we get the feeling. Again, as beginners, you may not have this quite down yet, whereas the people in the room who are much more advanced, they've got it down, this feeling of, oh yeah, blah, 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 back to the breath, or whatever you're using as your anchor. You develop a sense of humor about it. But when you're just beginners, it may be a lot harder because it's so compelling, you know, the story that the mind is in. Or even with people with a lot of experience, maybe this is the first time you've been able to sit for a minute the whole day. So the planning mind wants you, you know. It's, okay, we got to plan the schedule tomorrow. We have to do this, we have to do that. So then we see that that's running our show. And then we have this moment, and we let go of it. We let go of that thinking, and we go back to the breath. So, and for a while, as you're beginning in the first weeks, months, and years of practice, the feeling may be more that I have to keep letting go of. I'm letting go of thinking, I'm letting go of distraction, I'm letting go of planning, I'm letting go of that. But then, sooner or later, in your practice, you begin to feel the sweetness of letting go of that and letting go into relaxation in the present moment. And what a sweet relief that is. I call it the oasis of the present moment. That all of that stuff that the mind is doing, there is a respite from that. And we do it intentionally. We have to use mindfulness. Because if we don't, it'll just keep running. You know, the story will keep going. But with mindfulness and some concentration, we insert mindfulness and we make a choice. And I know for me, and I see, you know, many of the senior people here, it was a great turning point when I began to feel, instead of just that I was letting go of thinking, letting go of planning and all of that, but I was actually, the place I was going was so much better because you can just sigh, you can exhale and rest, There's the rising, falling sensation. There's the sensation of sitting, touching, breathing. It's so sweet and peaceful and uncomplicated. And that's a big shift in the practice. The practice starts moving to that release, that peace. And then there's a sense in that peace, the heart is opening more and more. And then we start letting go into heart opening. And that's really, really wonderful. You can also let go into forgiveness. You know, sometimes we have the story, and they did this, and they did that, and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, some of those memories go on for years. Some of the people that we're having difficulty forgiving aren't even on the planet anymore. And still, you know, it jumps you. You know, you may be in the car or the bus, some song comes on, and boom, you remember, and it's like, no, no, and they did that, and I did that, and so then, for a while, as our spiritual discipline, we might have the concept, oh, well, okay, let go of that. Forgiveness is good. Send some loving kindness and so forth. But then, again, as your practice strengthens and you get the flavor of this, you realize, you know, you're letting go into peace itself. And peace is just better. It just feels better in the body, in the heart. And so that sense of forgiveness becoming easier and easier, it's also kind of less conceptual. It's more a case of dissolving. And what's dissolving? This tight identity, which again, one of the major punchlines of the Buddhist tradition, this self. This ongoing, very tight story about this is who I am, this is what I do, this is what I think, this is what I think of them, this is what I think of me, this is who I'm not forgiving, this is who this is that. It's just very, very tight. It's very tense. It takes a lot of energy to hold that all together. It's sometimes, you know, your teeth grind from it, or you just feel that tightness. And then this learning to let go, and first we're training letting go of, but then as it begin to get this feeling of letting go into. And there are words, there are Dharma buzzwords, some people like them, some people don't. I kind of like them, but like spaciousness, openness, emptiness, this ongoing letting go into relaxation itself, but not asleep, very present, very aware, but this self-identity, you know, less and less, not much Jude left, you know, not much self-identity. Instead, this relaxed, open space where there is peace. Or equanimity, and equanimity. We have that word in Pali, upeka. Sense of balance, openness, equalness. And then we begin to feel that what lives in this space are the Brahma Viharas. Brahma means divine, God, realm. Vihara is a home. So this space, this spaciousness, this relaxed openness of mind and heart is the home of the Brahma Viharas. It's awesome. That's what's there. The Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, joy at others' joy, and equanimity. So it's like there's a space now. And then if some being comes walking or hopping by, the energy responds with friendliness. If a being comes who is in distress, the response is compassion. If there's a being celebrating, the response is celebration. And there is balance, the equalness, equanimity, balance of heart, and a sense of friendliness, compassion, equalness toward all. That's what lives in that relaxed space. And then more and more, one lets go into that space. Because it feels better than the tangle, than being entangled in the outer tangle. So yes, there will be things that we choose to let go of. There will be things, behaviors and things in our life that we will realize are unwholesome and not leading onward. Not leaning onward on our spiritual journey. Then we use willpower and we have to practice and it's hard, it's not easy, but we keep letting go of a lot of outer things that we see would be unwholesome for us. And then there is again and again this sense of letting go into peace itself, into calm, into spaciousness, letting go into compassion, into kindness. The flavor of that, just so, so sweet. And it's amazing. We make that journey through this very simple, though not easy, practice itself. The techniques themselves take us there if we persist. We continue and we persist. Of course, we do some study, we listen to talks, we come together listening to others' stories and to give each other support. There's certain ways that support all of this, but we see that the practice itself, designed by geniuses on the inner path, really trains us in developing the art, the craft, the skills, the gift of walking this journey, to begin to very much undo all the doing, releasing into peace, releasing, letting go into. Eventually, maybe, some life, this one or another, the experience that they say when the Buddha walked after he rose up from the tree under the Bodhi tree and spent a week thanking the tree. I love that. All Buddhas have trees that they're born under and then that they achieve enlightenment under, and they also die under trees. And in all the eons of ages, the different Buddhas through the eons have different trees, but they're all associated with a birth tree, an enlightenment tree, and a tree to die under. Isn't that wonderful? Just love that, the trees. So then he walked forth, and his friends who had turned him away because they thought he didn't have enough discipline, when they saw him coming at a distance, they could tell something completely different had happened. And so they asked, you know, what happened? And that's when he offered his first teaching. Ajahn Mun, the great 19th century Thai forest master, said, Nirvana is Pali, Nirvana is Sanskrit. Nirvana is the ultimate ease. The ultimate ease. A lot of us, you know, we start out the path, we're going to accomplish something. Accomplish enlightenment, you know, accomplish. Then you keep getting these hints from these great masters about relaxing and somehow letting go into something, relaxing into peace itself. If we struggle to accomplish something, that's not peace, right? We train, we learn eventually to relax into something that is present and available. I love Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh will often say things like, happiness is available, or peace is available, please help yourself. Of course, sometimes you think, I need a little more. But wanting to imply that It is here somehow. It's right here, right now. And all of our practice path is this training to let go into it. This is from Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. Letting go does not mean abandoning one thing in order to seek something else. It means giving up every comparison, seeing that there is nothing to be removed and nothing to be added, and that the boundary between ourselves and others is not real. We need not give up our human condition in order to become a Buddha. We seek Buddhahood in our very human condition, giving up nothing and seeking nothing. That is the meaning of apranihita, aimlessness, sometimes translated as wishlessness. I give that to you again. Letting go does not mean abandoning one thing in order to seek something else. It means giving up every comparison, seeing that there is nothing to be removed and nothing to be added, and that the boundary between ourselves and others is not real. We need not give up our human condition in order to become a Buddha. We seek Buddhahood in our very human condition, giving up nothing and seeking nothing. That is the meaning of apranihita, aimlessness, sometimes translated as wishlessness. Let's sit just for a moment here at the end of the evening, relaxing into, letting go into a presence, a peacefulness, no aim, no wish, just this one moment. Do everything with a mind that lets go. Do not expect any praise or reward. If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will know complete peace and freedom. Your struggles with the world will have come to an end. Thank you for your great practice.